Let's get started. Thank you. Today's and tomorrow's lectures will be about linear algebra, one of the most important topics in computational physics, or in computing overall, actually. And tomorrow afternoon, there will be a tutorial. And that tutorial, you will start working on your second project here, project on linear algebra. So linear algebra is, as said, is the most important topic in computational physics or in computer science. And that's arguably true because everything is linear algebra. Absolutely everything. For example, you see the characters on the screen. So the computer internally has a font. And when it puts them on the screen, then it takes these letters and it makes them slightly larger or smaller when I hit plus or minus. And of course, making something larger or smaller, that is applying a matrix operation onto the bit vector that represents the font. So when I scroll here and new letters appear, then hundreds, millions of linear algebra operations are happening in the background. And in fact, there's a thing called floating point operations. If you add matrices, multiply vectors, and so on, then you do that. And this laptop here, which is not a very fast computer, can probably do about a trillion operations per second. Not a billion, a trillion, about 10 to 12. And larger computers are even faster. Hollywood used to be big, but these days computer games are a bigger business than Hollywood. I don't know whether it's $10 or $100 billion a year. And if you think about 3D rendered movies or computer games, they work by taking surfaces, say a human surface or something, breaking it down into little triangles that live in the virtual world. And then these virtual triangles are projected on the virtual screen so that you do that. It happens with millions or billions of triangles. It happens 60 times a second so that you can move fluidly through the screen, through the scene. And that, of course, tells you how many linear algebra operations are happening there. So it used to be that when new hardware is developed, then the CPU manufacturers look at, for example, also scientific computing and see what they need and develop new processors that support scientific computing. These days, it's the other way around. Because computer gaming is so prevalent, then many of the new processors that are developed just for computer games and for linear algebra. And it's the researchers that look at that hardware and see how they can use it for scientific computing. So this computer here has two different kinds of CPUs in there. The regular CPU that you do for word processing and key presses and so on. And another thing called a GPU, a graphics processing unit, that is about 5 times faster, has 5 times the computing power, just approximately. And basically all it does is linear algebra. So if you think about money or wherever, anything, it's all linear algebra in the background. So today I want to give you a brief introduction to linear algebra. I could, of course, lecture for a whole year on linear algebra, how to do that numerically. That's not possible in this course. So I will just teach you the important concepts. And then when you actually encounter it in a problem, then you have heard the concepts and you know where to go, how to do something. So let's first start with vectors and matrices. You know Julia. And today you can either follow along if you want to, or you can just get my notebook after the lecture. But the project on which you will be working starting tomorrow is based on what we're doing today. So following along is highly encouraged. And feel free to stop me if I'm too fast. So you know how to write vectors manually. For example, what is happening here? Sorry, something wrong with the keyboard. 1, 2, 3, you can define a vector explicitly. And there are also other ways to get a vector. For example, 0s, 4 is a four-dimensional vector consisting of zeros. 1s, or 4, gives you 4 ones. 2, 4 gives you a vector with 4 elements consisting of 0. You can get random vectors. That's very good for testing things out. These are 4 random numbers drawn from a uniform distribution between 0 and 1. That's what Julia defaults to for real numbers. And there's another thing called rand n. This gives you a vector drawn from a normal distribution. These numbers can be positive or negative. They're kind of peaked around 0, but they can be larger than just 1. So let's get a bit of a larger vector to make it interesting with 10 elements. And with matrices, the same thing. You can write a matrix manually. 1, 2, semicolon, 3, 4, 5, 6. This gives you a matrix with 3 rows. Each row has 2 columns. Looks like that. You can use zeros and ones in the same way. I'm not going to do that. There is a special matrix. I need a square matrix for that. Okay. Let's write zeros, 4, 4. That gives a 4 by 4 matrix full of zeros. And there's a special matrix called I, uppercase I. And this is the identity matrix, but it doesn't know what size it has. Rather, it looks at the environment at which it is used and then adapts to the right size. So A plus I is added to A. A is a 4 by 4 matrix, so this is going to be the 4 by 4 identity matrix. Haha, okay, yes. I forgot to use a package. There's a building package for linear algebra. Going to have to load that. And then this I works. I is the identity matrix.
That's quite magical. It just magically knows something to me.
So internally, this magic uses the type system. If we look of I is a special type called uniform scaling. And then the special operations such as addition and multiplication are overloaded. So if one of these arguments is this uniform scaling, such a uniform scaling object, then it knows how to handle that. So for example, if you write I times another matrix, then of course nothing would actually happen. Because if you multiply with the identity matrix, you don't need to perform any operations. So this is actually faster than defining such a matrix yourself. Now we have A and X. Let's make A a bit larger. 10 by 10. And then matrix multiplication is written just with a regular operator. Matrix becomes a vector, gives another vector. And unlike other systems, Julia distinguishes between row and column vectors. In relativity, you call them covariant and contravariant vectors. In quantum mechanics, they're called the Bra vectors and Ket vectors. I don't know whether that's the notation, is the terminology that you're using. So if I write X times A, the result would be an error message because X has the wrong shape. And to fix that, one way would be to write X transpose times A. So the back tick afterwards is the transpose. Oh man. You can also write transpose explicitly. Okay, yeah, here you don't see that it's the transpose. There are all these random numbers in there. That's not really useful. And then of course let's create another vector y. And then if you write y transpose times a times x, the result will be scalar, as expected.
Sorry, so for a matrix, you have to write, like, you have to fully write transpose, but for a vector, you...
No, both are the same.
Okay.
It's just when Julia introduces a shortcut notation with an apostrophe, sometimes it's confusing, and therefore they always also have the longer name that you can write out just for convenience. Okay. And of course, with the indexing and so on, you can write y1 times a, 2, 3. I showed that earlier, times x of 4. You all know that. There's nothing special about that. Not going to go over that anymore. Yes. Let's look at the type of X transpose. You see, it has a special type. Vector float 64, that was the type of X. Let's write type of x. Oh man, the slowdown. I assumed it was fixed. It is not. X is just the vector of float 64. And type of xpros has a different type, adjoint of x. That means when you transpose a vector internally, the object is not changed. The representation internally does not change. So it takes no floating point operation to transpose a matrix. Nothing is copied in memory. Just the type is changed. So later, when you say multiply a matrix or a vector, the multiplication is again overloaded, whether it is transposed or not, and does the most efficient thing. And when it comes to efficiency these days, the thing that is expensive is usually actually memory access, not floating point operations. So in that sense, adding two matrices, the most important thing about that is not the adding operations, but actually reading the data from memory and writing it back to memory. And from that point of view, doing nothing when you transpose something is a rather perfect optimization, because transposing would just copy things in memory around, would do nothing interesting, and therefore you save that. And then, oh yeah, let's type of x transpose, and let's see what happens. Yes, it goes back to the original vector. So the transpose of a transpose does nothing. And the same operations exist also for complex numbers. That's why it's called an adjoint, because it actually not just the transpose, it's transposed and complex conjugated, as you expect. And I want to show you one more operation, and that has to do with reshaping matrices. Sometimes you're dealing with, for example, not a matrix, but a higher dimensional object, say a 3 or 4 dimensional array or a tensor. Or sometimes you have a matrix, and that is 2 by 4, but you want to reshape it into a 4 by 2 matrix. And this reshaping just takes the same numbers, it just interprets them differently. I'll give you an example. I'll write a matrix, which is a 3-dimensional thing. Let's hope I get that right. 1, 2, 3, 4. Sorry, now I want to create something that is rather easy, not too complicated. 2 by 2 by 2. Now let's try it by hand. But that's just a 2 by 3 matrix. Okay. Like that. Good. That is a 2 by 2 by 2 array. So you can think of it as a vector of matrices, or a matrix of vectors, and kind of these two matrices, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, stop. It's kind of a rank 3 tensor that you get. And sometimes you want to reinterpret that instead of a 2 by 2 by 2 array as a 4 by 2 array. And there's this operation reshape that allows you to do that. So if you like, reshape m, 4, 2. And this is a rank 3 array with shape 2 by 2 by 2. And then we get a 4 by 2 matrix. And we can also reshape it differently. And you see, when you go through the numbers, they all stay in the same order. So this doesn't change the memory layout. What it does, it takes the matrix, it interprets the matrix as a single vector of numbers, all the entries of the matrix strung together, and then chops it up into a different shape. And obviously, when you call reshape, that shape here needs to have the same total number of elements as the other matrix. And this also allows you to interpret the matrix as a vector. You know, matrices form a vector space as well. And sometimes that can be confusing. And sometimes the code is easier when you take the matrix and just reshape it into a vector. And that is also a very efficient operation. It doesn't actually do any heavy lifting. So we have this matrix A here. And let's just reshape it into a single vector. God, that's going to be large on the screen. Here is this, oh yeah. Luckily, Julia doesn't show us everything. So we have taken this matrix and reshaped it into a single vector. Let's call it A vec, because it's A is a vector. And we can do the other thing. We can reshape A vec into, again, 10 by 10 matrix, and then we get the original matrix I. And we can ask Julia whether this is identical to the original matrix A. That's true. Yes, yes. So you're not going to use the reshaping, but you should have heard of it. That's an important concept that appears everywhere. It makes many things much simpler and much more efficient.
Sorry, where did you define AVIC? Was it in the...
Oh, sorry, that was here, just when I called the reshape.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah, I thought I was going to move on faster to another topic. That's why I created these 10 by 10 thingies instead of staying with 2 and 3 dimensions where everything fits on the screen. But I didn't do that yet. Okay, I'm typing everything into an empty notebook, and I'm not copying and pasting, and I hope that slows me down. And I'm still probably twice as fast as I should be. So I want you to ask more questions and slow me down. Rustin, you can raise your hand if I'm truly too fast. It's a good thing that my notebook slows down. So I want to talk about matrix types. What we discussed so far is what is called a dense matrix or a full matrix. And you know that sometimes if a matrix has certain properties that can be convenient, for example, you know that the eigenvalues of a just standard any matrix will be complex, but eigenvalues of a symmetric matrix will be real. That is an important property. So, and if a matrix is symmetric, that might be an important property to know about a matrix. And similarly, if a matrix can have some other properties, for example, it could be that the matrix is diagonal. That, of course, means only the diagonal elements are non-zero. That's much more efficient to store the matrix because you don't need to store all the zeros. Also, multiplying with the diagonal matrix is super fast, because you don't need to do any of the multiplications with zero. You just need to scale by the diagonal elements. And similarly, there are, what's it called? Bi or tri diagonal matrices, where you just have the main diagonal and several off diagonals. In many cases, algorithms that you use on the computer, for example, to invert a matrix, to multiply them, look for eigenvalues, if these algorithms know about these properties, they will be much faster. I mean, not just a factor 2 or 3 faster. They can be 100 times faster, 1 million times faster for large matrices. So these properties are really important. Although, if you just type something into Mathematica with a generic representation or do something on the blackboard, you wouldn't know. The largest matrix you handle on the blackboard is probably 4 by 4, because everything would be way too tedious. But in a computer, I told you about trillions of operations per second, it is very easy to have vector spaces with 1 million dimensions. And when you discretize the Einstein equations to study black holes, everything is linear algebra, right? So discretizing something, of course, that's also linear algebra, then you can easily have vector spaces with a dimension of 1 billion or larger. And then, of course, getting respective speed ups is super important. Otherwise, you wouldn't stand a chance. So that is really important to know about these things. Is there something else I wanted to mention? I think I'm forgetting something here. I'll add it later. And there's also the idea of sparse matrices. And a sparse matrix just means that most of the entries are zero. But generally, you don't know which entries. It could be some irregular pattern, but still most are zero. And then, of course, if you handle a sparse matrix, that can make things much more efficient. And Julia has different types. I'm not going to talk about sparse matrices today. I'm going to do that tomorrow. Has different types for that. So, example, the type of A is just matrix. And we can turn that into a symmetric matrix. We're calling symmetric. And then the type will change. See, it's symmetric of matrix. It's the same thing again. And if you look at the entries, they are now symmetric, minus point something, blah, or here at the other end, and so on. And the question is, how does Julia turn the matrix into something symmetric, it's not particularly clever. It's really brute force. You can just subtract the original matrix and then you'll see. You see, the upper triangle is correctly handled correctly and the lower triangle isn't. So if you turn a matrix into a symmetric matrix, Julia just uses the upper triangle. And that's not really a nice thing. So usually when you want a symmetric matrix, I would write something like A plus A transpose, because then you have something that is symmetric. And then by calling the symmetric constructor, you tell Julia that it's symmetric. And if it's just a bit non-symmetric, Julia does the right thing. But if it's really non-symmetric, then Julia does something that properly surprises you.
So the main thing it does here is change the type.
The only thing that symmetric does is change the type. Doesn't change the memory layout. And it just disregards the lower triangular. And that was the type I forgot here. Haha. Triangular matrices. Let's add that here. And you can also create a diagonal matrix. Diagonal. I think you create it from a vector. So rand n 10 gives you a vector with 10 elements, and calling diagonal all that gives you then a diagonal matrix. And you saw it doesn't store the off-diagonal elements, it just outputs dot, it doesn't even output zero. Why should it bother to do that? And in a similar way, you could have tri-diagonal, bi-diagonal, symmetric tri-diagonal matrices, and so on. There's a huge chapter about linear algebra in Julia in the documentation. You can just click there and look for some of these things and find more information. You're not going to do that, but the symmetric is actually important. Now, you notice I didn't write something for antisymmetric matrices, because for some reason, antisymmetric matrices do not appear that often. I don't know why. Maybe antisymmetric matrices, you just say, oh, they are complex Hermitian, and then complex conjugated, so the imaginary part is antisymmetric. Another reason could be if you multiply two symmetric matrices, then the result is symmetric. If you multiply two antisymmetric matrices, the result is also symmetric. So symmetric matrices are kind of closed under matrix multiplication, and antisymmetry is not. That could be one reason maybe why they are not important. But it just happens that in numerical algorithms, people typically don't encounter antisymmetric matrices. It's weird if you think of differential forms, there's lots of antisymmetries there, lots of elegance.
All the time.
You do?
Yeah, it's determinants I do. And
yes.
Positive if they're antisymmetric, so they're very nice.
Yes, that goes in the same direction as differential forms and so on. That's there. Okay, well, maybe it's just a random thing. Maybe there's a hole in linear algebra that wants to be filled. Maybe you should write a Julia package for antisymmetric matrices. Okay, now let's go to the next topic, which is transforming matrices. And the first thing that everybody encounters is probably, let's look at the inverse of a matrix, right? We have A, and then the inverse of A, you just write inf of A, and then you get the inverse. And of course, inverting a 10 by 10 matrix manually is hopeless, but for a computer, this is a very easy task. And then we can also multiply the inverse by A to see whether the result is the identity matrix. And the result is, of course, oh, come on. And then we broke Julia. What is wrong here?
Julia.
Yeah. Okay, so the problem is that, and I need to talk about that, that we are not talking about real numbers here. We only have floating point numbers. I don't know whether you've been introduced to that. If we multiply the inverse of A times A and look the result, and we see that these numbers are really small. Don't get confused by the 3.19. That's not 3.19. That's times 10 to the minus 16. So all these numbers here are really small, 10 to the minus 16 or thereabouts. And you have 1 on the diagonal. And that is just floating point accuracy. So So I want to briefly talk about floating point numbers because they're usually treated as if they were magic.
Hey.
Hello?
Do you hear me?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So earlier I thought you mentioned that we are not going to get any floating number error or something. So it's nothing is happening in the Julia. So again, we are seeing that, I mean, this due to the floating number difference, right? These 10 to the minus 17 and 16.
Yes, exactly.
But I thought it's not going to happen in Julia based on
okay.
what you mentioned earlier, or maybe I misunderstood. Would you please?
Yes.
Explain.
Yes, I'll expand on that. So there are different kinds of numbers in Julia. They are integers, of course. They are rational numbers, and they are floating point numbers. If you use a language like Fortran, then you'd have integers and floating point numbers. It's much more difficult to use rational numbers in Fortran. And if you use floating point numbers, they have a finite accuracy. You just have to deal with that. There's no way around that. But Julia makes it very easy to use rational numbers. And if you do use rational numbers, then you don't get these problems. And that is comparable to Mathematica. If you write 1 over 5 in Mathematica, you get a rational number. And if you write 0.2, that's a floating point number. And that propagates. So if you have a large rational matrix in Mathematica, it would invert it using rational numbers, and you get no error. And if you have a matrix of floating point numbers, then you would get the floating point error. It's the same thing in Julia. And I don't know about rational numbers in Python or Fortran, but they are much less commonly used. I'm sure there's a package for rational numbers. And since you mentioned about that before going to floating point numbers, let me just do something with rational numbers. So let's invent a matrix. Let's call it B and fill it with rational numbers. Okay, so we need to get some random numbers. So this is the range from minus 100 to 100. This gives us just a single random number from that interval that's not useful. Then let's convert it into a matrix. Then we have a matrix of integers. And let's now convert that into a matrix of rational numbers. Now, I also mentioned earlier that Julia has both integers and big integers. Regular integers go to 10 to the 20 or thereabouts. They're super fast. But then you get integer overflow errors. And the big integers can get arbitrarily large. But in Julia, you need to switch manually between these two different rational different representations. So let's make these big integers. And then let's convert these into rational numbers. I'm waiting for my user interface again. Actually, let's just do it like that. Divide by 100. This double slash divides. But that's a rational number division, so it doesn't converge to a floating point number. And then we should have a matrix of rational numbers based on big int. That complication here is just creating them, because you can't draw rational numbers from a distribution. It works for floating point numbers and for integers, but not for rational numbers. So I draw from these integers, and I make them big because it has to be manual. And then I divide by 100, and then all these entries will be between minus 1 and plus 1. Then I invert this matrix. And now you see why I use big integers, because these rational numbers here are just atrocious. I mean, look at the numerator and denominator and so on. It's absolutely crazy. But this is now the identity matrix. You don't see it because the denominator 1 is everywhere. But we can just compare to the identity matrix, and it is true. It is right there. So that is a cool thing you can do in Julia. But handling rational numbers is much more expensive than handling floating point numbers. There's a reason people use floating point numbers. So when I said a trillion operations a second, that's only for floating point numbers. Rational numbers are probably 100 or 1,000 times slower. Yes?
If you're using floating point numbers, is there a way to then, like if we had what we had before where it's almost the identity, is there a way to kind of suppress small numbers and turn them into zero? And so we do end up with the identity?
Yes, there is. Okay, I wanted to show that. Okay, sorry, scrolling slow again. After explaining what floating numbers are, but since you asked, let's just do with that. First, inf a. So there's this function isApprox you can call, whether that checks whether things are approximately the same. And there is also a shortcut for that, where you type backslash approx. That's the LaTeX notation, if you know LaTeX. You hit the tab key, and then you get these squiggles. And if the font is large enough, you see that's not an equal sign. That's instead the squiggles. And that is actually true. And this is approx. You can specify a relative and then absolute tolerance and so on. And in some other language, there's a function called chop that you call. And chop would take any numbers that are smaller than 10 to the minus 10 and set them to 0. Julia does not have a chop function because that only works for things that are approximately 0. What if you have a number that is 1 and another number that is very close to 1? It's 1 plus 10 to the minus 15. The chop function would not work in that, but there is approx would still work. Yes?
How did you get the approximation symbol?
Okay.
Slash is approx tab.
Backslash approx, and then you hit the tab key. And you can also get nice Greek letters for that. If you want to call something row, that works. Or right arrow. Or you want to have the in symbol for A in B for sets or something, you get that answer. It is, yes. There are probably 10,000 different symbols. I mean, all of Unicode is available here. Pretty cool. Yeah, you need to make sure. There are many things that look very similar and you can get very confusing things.
Can you have emoji variable names now?
I don't know. How did you get emoji in?
Oh my God.
Here, smile. Smile equals 42. There you go.
What?
Smile. No, 42. It should look different. I don't know why the smile is up there. Oh, and of course you can write x dot as a variable 9 and x prime and so on and so forth. Okay, I'll stop now. That is a cool thing. I should have mentioned it before. Okay, floating point numbers. How are they represented internally? I probably mentioned that floating point numbers are a subset of the rational numbers. So an internal representation of a floating point number is an integer m times 2 to the e, where e is also an integer. So all the floating point numbers that you see, they're an integer, and then are scaled by a power of 2. So if you have, for example, 1 over 256, then you know that integer is 1, and that exponent e is minus 8. That gives you 1 over 256. And if you have the number 0.1, which looks as if it could be represented exactly, it can't, because 1 over 10 is not representable as a power of 2. Oh, no, you can. Can it not? No, it cannot. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm having the Blackfoot syndrome now. Okay, let's just write 0.1 and let's convert it into a rational number. Okay, yeah. So this is how 0.1 looks internally. So a floating point number is not a fuzzy concept. It's not some mushy thing or anything. A floating point number is a very specific rational number. It just needs to have this form here. So if you type 0.1, there is no floating point number, that is 0.1. So what the computer does, it looks for the nearest representable floating point number that is closest to 0.1, and that happens to be this weird rational number. But it is stored super efficiently. If I'm not mistaken, there is a double precision. double precision, uses 64 bits. M is stored as 52 bits, and E as 12 bits. No, that's not true. E is 11 bits, and M is stored as 52 bits, which is together 64 bits, of course. That's 53 bits, including the sign. And there are some certain tricks and other that I'm not going into. If you want to learn more about floating point numbers, go to Wikipedia. They have even nice sketches how it's represented internally in all the special cases. It turns out zero is a special case because there are certain conditions on M. One of the conditions is that it can't be zero and so on. There's single precision, which is 32 bits, half precision, which is 16 bits. And in 16 bits, you can just get 3 decimal digits or something. So double precision has about 15 digits. 10 to minus 16 was the error, right? So it's about correct to 16 decimal digits. Turns out that 52 binary digits correspond to about 16 decimal digits. The conversion factor is the log 10 to base 2, which is something like 2 or 3. And there is even something like 8 bits these days for machine learning where you really don't need that much precision internally. Oh no, man. Ah, okay. It doesn't look good. Okay, here. So the most important thing is this idea that every floating point number internally, it's an integer scaled by a power of 2. And many numbers that you see on the screen cannot be represented exactly. And it doesn't mean that the numbers are fuzzy all the time. The fuzziness only happens when you go from something on the screen, say from point 1 to this number here. We can calculate rational 0.1, then we subtract 1 over 10. And this is the difference. And we can convert this decimal difference again to a floating point number. So the difference between the point 1 is floating point number, and the actual value, point 10, is about 10 to the minus 17, which is the accuracy. Yes?
Why there are different precision types and how are they used?
Oh, the more bits you use, the more expensive the calculation gets. So as a rule of thumb, to double the number of bits makes things twice as expensive. And for example, double precision is the standard these days. But in many cases, you don't need 15 bits. If you have a measurement, what measurement do you get with 15 bits? I don't know. There's something about K mesons with 18 or 20 digits. Not bits, digits. But for many things, you just need less precision. And then everything goes faster. And I mentioned earlier machine learning, where you have huge neural networks that you want to train. And that takes an inordinate amount of computing time. And of course, if you can make that go faster, then you want to. And that's why people go down to 16 or even 8 bits in some cases there. And it's good enough for these calculations. So why do something? And sometimes, of course, you need more than 16 bits. You can have a weird thing. You can have two numbers that are very, very close to each other. They only differ in the 20th digit or something. And then a floating point number calculation, 64 bits would not be enough. And then there's quadruple precision where you get even more. Oh, there's big float in Julia where you can also do that. Big float then uses internally, I think, 256 bits. And you can change it that it's about 80 digits. So pi internally is a special type. If you multiply pi, you convert it to a 64-bit number, you get these many digits. And if you convert it to a big float number, you should get 80 digits of pi. And you can change the big float position and get even more digits of pi. Okay, so this floating point and the finite position that you're getting is really important. And there's a rule of thumb. You should never compare floating point numbers for equality, unless you know that it actually works. If you know, for example, that your floating point number is exactly an integer, then you can compare it because it works. But if you do a wild calculation with matrices, you should never compare for equality. You always need to leave a tolerance, and isapprox is a good way of doing that.
Variable that can store the most number of digits, number of bytes in Julia? Is there anything bigger than big float?
I mean, No, I think big float is the largest, and you can change the position for big float somehow. I don't know how to do that. And for big int, there is no precision. They can be as large as you want. And if you have rational numbers of big int, they can also get as large as you want.
Because you didn't define pi was stored in Julia itself.
No, I think pi is calculated via some equation. It's probably the, I don't know, arc cosine of minus 1 or something.
Yeah.
And minus 1 can be stored exactly. And arc cosine is probably some Taylor series. And then depending on the number of digits that you're using, it uses more and more terms, and that converges super fast. So if you wanted a million digits, I don't know how to do that, but in principle, I guess you could change the big float position, and then you get pi to a million digits.
You change big float to what?
You could change the big float precision to be not just 80 digits, but a million digits.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could these calculations. I don't know how to do that. I read it in the documentation. I forgot. You could probably look up how that works with big float. And there might also be other packages that allow you to do that. But I didn't prepare for that topic.
Can I ask a question, Eric?
Please, go ahead.
Thank you. So if is there a way that we could set the precision? I mean, a cutoff in the entire code, for example, not to call. So, or even if the approximate has 10 to the minus 15 or 16, and beyond that, set everything to zero or to be equal if the difference is less than that. What if I need 10 to the minus 8 and beyond to be zero? Can I set something like that in the beginning of my code and then say, okay, this isn't the precision that I need for this calculation or the entire package that I'm writing or whatever?
So,
need to repeat it every time.
If you'd use less precision, then you would call isApprox with certain options. For example, we can call isApprox and then compare 1 and 1 plus, user interface is stuck again, 10 to the minus 4. Oh, come on. And the result would be false because they're too far apart. And then I can specify an absolute tolerance to 10 to the minus 3, and then it would say this is true. And you could, if you need less precision, you could do that. You could call the isApprox function, and you could store a global constant where you say the precision that you want and use that global constant here. I mean, I put the number in directly, but you put the global constant here. And then you could compare it to a much coarser precision. On the other hand, if you want more precision than the 15 digits that you get from double precision, then you would probably use a package. There's a package called double floats, I guess, which gives you about 25 or 30 digits that you could use. Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Do you want more detail?
Yes, thank you. That's perfect. Thank you very much. And another question that I wanted to ask is that, so again, now can we set this? Is there an option to do like this A tolerance that you did, but for the entire notebook or for your entire code? Then if you multiply A with inverse of A, then it gives you 1, actually.
If there's a numerical error, some inaccuracy, that means you don't know what the result should be. So A inverse times A, you can never round it towards the identity matrix because you don't know in which direction you would round. You can only compare it to the identity matrix and say, yes, within that accuracy, it is correct. But you can't change the result to be the identity matrix. This is not how rounding works.
Yeah, I understand. Exactly.
Okay.
What
you can do is you can use your.
Yes.
Okay, then I don't. Okay, maybe const toll equals 1 e minus 3. You can do it like that. And then whenever you compare things, you can call this function. And whenever you compare to this function, parsing these options, you're using this tolerance. And this is a global constant that you specify. And you can even define your own comparison function. Y is approx a comma b equals is approx a comma b with that tolerance. And then you can call y is approx, you choose a different names. And you compare with this function, and then it always uses this tolerance, and you have defined this function somewhere at the top of your notebook. And of course, you can choose a different name here. And you can, I don't know, you can even find a nice Unicode character. I don't know, don't use double squiggles, but do something else. Double squiggles with a hat or something maybe. And then you could use that if you want that. I wanted to show one small thing about matrix decompositions, how the inverse of a matrix and how eigenvalues work internally, but I can do that later. Now, I wanted to show you a very important algorithm called least squares. Justin alluded to it, where you can turn optimization problems into linear algebra, because everything is linear algebra, but you know that by now. Could you switch on light to the blackboard? Oh, wow, no, how? Oh, thanks. Okay, so I'm going to describe a very particular optimization problem, but least squares works for all kinds of optimization problems. The basic idea is that you have a goal function, an objective function that is quadratic. You want to find the minimum of a quadratic function. Finding the minimum means you set the gradient to zero. The gradient of the quadratic function is a linear function. Setting something to zero for a linear function means solving a linear system. That's the idea here. So the basic idea that what I want to show here is how to approximate a function. It's usually called analysis when you write a Taylor expansion and so on. But of course, even analysis breaks down to linear algebra in the end. I mean, you get the idea now. So let's approximate, for example, the sine function. But we're not going to use a Taylor approximation. We're going to use a different thing. So we want to approximate the sine function, sine of x via polynomials. So the basic idea is we take certain number, we want to represent the sine function in a particular way, and we're going to make this ansatz. There's going to be a function f of x. Is that large enough? Can you see that? You probably can't write my squiggles here, but can't you read the equations? We want to write that as a sum p equals 0 to some number, big n, and there's going to be some coefficient ci times polynomials. Just x to the p. And if we use infinitely many polynomials, then we can't use the Taylor expansion, then we get the sine function or something very nice. But the problem with the Taylor expansion is that the function needs to be analytic. And many functions are not analytic. They might not be differentiable, they might have noise on it, and so on. As a rule of thumb, if you take a derivative numerically, then you amplify any noise that might be there. And taking one or two derivatives might be okay, but if you want to have a 10th order representation, you need to take the 10th derivative of something, and usually numerically that is just out of the question. You would be drowning in noise. 15 digits don't save you there. On the other hand, if you integrate something, then you smooth out everything. If you integrate a function, the function has a bit of noise, then chances are half the noise cancels out anyway, and everything is nice. So numerically, integrating is very nice. So we want this approximation for the sine function to be as exact as possible. And to simplify it, we are not going to do an exact integral, but we're just going to consider the interval on an interval I, which is, say, from 0 to pi over 2. And we are going to choose 101 points on that interval. and we are going to look at the difference between the sine function and whatever else we would want to approximate, rod sine, cosine, logarithm, any complicated thing. And our ansatz function here, we compare it at these 101 function, 101 points, and then we want to minimize the square of the differences. So this is the ansatz function here. Then we choose points. This is the front. Okay, a different number. How many points do we choose? N, P, oh, I need a letter that's not confusing. Okay, choose R points on that interval I. So, and then we have points xi equals, and then it's pi over 2 times I over r minus 1 or something. If we put in I equals 0, then the first point is 0. That's the first point at the interval. If we put, no, we need to divide by r. Oh, this is so complicated. I'll let you figure that out. Anyway, the first point should be at 0. And the last point at the moment, if we set I to r, no, r minus 1. If we have r points, then we label them 0 to r minus 1. And the last point is r minus 1. So then r minus 1 over r minus 1 is 1. And then we get xi equals pi over 2. That's that function Lin range that Julia has. This is that you don't need to write this out manually, right? This is just called Lin range. So then we have r points. And at these r points, we look at the difference. So the goal function, objective function, I'll call it a goal function, is g. And that is we sum over all these points from I equals 0 to r minus 1. At all these points, we calculate the difference between the sine function, sine of xi. We subtract our ansatz function here. Well, let's write it out. P equals 0 to n c. Oh, sorry, that is a p here, of course. Okay, this is a coefficient p, and this is x to the p power. Let's put this down here. Then we have cp times x to the p power. And then we square that. And if our approximation is really good, the difference is going to be small. And then the goal function is going to be very close to 0. The goal function is by construction positive. And we want to choose these coefficients, cp, so that we're approximating the sine function over whatever we want to approximate. And this is a generic ansatz. If you want to optimize something, setting the square to 0, it's nice. And the other things here, having a certain number of parameters that we can choose and taking a certain number of measurements. Justin called this the model, because this is the function that we have. And these were the data points, the xi. Our model here has, I don't know, we have a 10th order approximation. Our model has 10 control parameters. And we have 100 data points here. That's much larger than what Dustin did, because then he wanted to actually show it to you in a 2D graph. Here we can easily have 100 or 1,000 dimensions. And we just do it using linear algebra. And now we need to translate that into, oh, and the goal is to minimize g. Let's write it down.
This is also the log likelihood of the joint Gaussian probability if the sigmas are all the same, because the sigma term of the Gaussian drops out, and then that's the log part of the sigma.
Oh, yes, you could. You could put a sigma term here in front. You could have a different weight for each of the xi's. Would that where the sigma goes? I'm not familiar with the translation.
Yeah, but this is just the part that's normally in X exponent of the normal distribution. So then there's a, if you do a, all that over sigma I squared, then it's just the, then it's the Gaussian.
Okay. Now we take this, we take this, and we translate it to linear algebra. In my mind, that I had another line where I can write this. There's now a different blackboard here. So it's not really as easy. But we now need to identify matrices and vectors in the equation above here. Now, obviously, sine of xi. Xi are the points that we are choosing. They are fixed. We chose them. We are not going to change them. And the sine at these xi, these are fixed values as well. So that looks a bit complicated, but we can just calculate all the sine of xi. And this then turns into, oh, I hope that makes sense, that this just continues here. You can just this call b, a vector b. Now, there are different notations for vectors. Which do you prefer? The standard linear algebra notation, bra and kit vectors, or abstract index notation? No one speaks up. You want bra and kits? Or is that, you want that? OK, very good. Then b is a vector. And c, of course, is also a vector. And in bra and kit, I have to reverse the. Reverse the order. And the XPR, sorry, it's XI to the pth power. The powers P are fixed, the XI are picked. So this term depends on both the point where we look, XI, and the power P. So this is going to be a matrix. So it's going to look, let's call it A, just because it's a matrix, and B. And you need to be careful. In quantum mechanics, operators usually Hermitian. This matrix A is not Hermitian and not symmetric. Can you see why? It's very simple.
Is any matrix? It's not, you didn't impose hermeticity or?
Yes, that's one thing. But in general, it's not even a square matrix. It's rectangular because you have a certain number of points that could be 101 and a certain number of a power, say a 10th order. So we have 10 and 100. So this is going to be a rectangular thing in general. And you need to be careful when you use bra and kit notation. You get A transpose and so on. Anyway, this is just the term in the parenthesis. So now, we would need to write the squares as well. So in terms of bracket notation, this becomes then the transpose of that. So then we have transpose that. C and A transpose, because that's different, minus B, sorry. And another parenthesis here. And I hope that you check me, because I'm doing that live on a blackboard. I'm not reading off notes. And the sum and so on is all implicit. And then we have, let's first get the B terms, because they're easy. This is just B and B, the dot product. And since B is given, and this is a square, this is a term that we get, but we don't actually care about the term, because we can't modify it. It doesn't depend on C. It's just going to be an offset when we optimize the Gold function here. And then we get another term. Let's do the cross term first. Let's do it manually. C A transpose B minus B A C, and the last term plus C A transpose A C. Okay, you do get the symmetric operator in the end in here. So this is the Gold function G that we want to optimize. And the thing that we can vary are the parameters C. I mentioned that these are the things that we want to choose. Yes? Mm-hmm.
The last two minus.
Is there a negative sign missing
whole thing. There should be a negative on.
Oh man, thank you. Yes, there's a negative here and a plus here.
That's good, yeah.
And now it's correct? Oh, cool, cool. That was quick. Thank you. Thank you. Anyway, so the parameters that we can choose are C, A and B are fixed. They come from the ansatz that we have. And to minimize G, we know, so this is not linear algebra yet, because this term here is quadratic in C. And linear algebra doesn't deal well with solving quadratic equation. That's not what we can do. But we don't want to solve it. We want to minimize it. To minimize it, we take the gradient with respect to C. And that is then something that we want to set to zero, because to be in a minimum, the gradient must be zero. Now to take the gradient of that, well, that term drops out because it doesn't depend on C, is good. We don't want that term anyway. This term here then becomes minus BA. This term here is a bit complicated because we get the transpose of that when we take a gradient with respect to C, but it works out nice to be a factor 2 here. And this here gives 2CA transpose A. And since we took a gradient with respect to a vector, we get a covector, we get a bra thing. And we want to set this thing to 0. Of course, we can just take the overall transpose of that. And then we get the equation A transpose A times C. Put this on the other side as well. Equals A transpose B. Oh man, I probably messed up the A's and A transposes. I hope I didn't. This is BA. No, it's probably correct. So this is the equation we want to solve. The thing is, if this holds, then we are at the local minimum of G. Since it's a quadratic form, there is only one minimum. And if the C satisfies this condition, then we have found the minimum. That is the best approximation under this norm. And you see that C and B live in different vector spaces, and A translates between these vector spaces. So C, we apply the matrix A, and then A transpose, then we are in the same vector space in that C wants to live. B lives in the other one, we apply A transpose, then we are also in the vector space in which C lives. So these are kind of consistent. Now another question, can we cancel the A transpose here? No, yes, so A is a rectangular matrix, and if we just leave it out, we would change the number of solutions. In particular, here, C has a certain number of unknowns, say 10, and we also have then 10 equations. If you just look at the different shapes, how this is translates. If we leave out the A transpose, then we get a B here, and we say it above, for example, B could have 100 points, then we have 100 equations for 10 unknowns in C, and that would not work out here. But here, if we solve it like this, then we have 10 equations for 10 unknowns, and that works all the time. It's a bit magic that this allows us to solve a system where we want to impose 100 conditions on just 10 unknowns, and this just solves the system to be as good as possible. So it finds a unique solution independent of what happens. Yes?
To clarify, the size of B is going to be n? The size of C will be N, and then the size of B will be R.
Yes, or plus minus 1. I wasn't careful about that. Yes, that is the case.
In practice, do you usually choose R much larger than N? Or like what sort of the...
Depends on the problem. It can also be the other way around. You can also have 100 unknowns and just 10 conditions. Say you just want to have an approximation. And you have a model with 10 parameters, and you only have 2 data points, and that's kind of an underdetermined system. This will also spit out a unique solution for that. It works as well. And solving that system, I'm getting a bit ahead of myself. I'll try logging in a few minutes. It also works if, say, both dimensions are the same, but this matrix A that you have somehow has a zero eigenvalue. There are some linear dependencies as well. So anytime you have a linear system that you want to solve, independent of how your matrix looks like or whether it has bad eigenvalues, whether the matrix is invertible, this kind of least squares method will spit out a unique solution. Whether that solution makes sense or not is something else, but it's really widely applicable. Now, let's assume you have a different problem. You have a matrix, and the matrix is not invertible. It might be rectangular, it might have a zero eigenvalue or something. And instead of saying that A inverse times A should be the identity matrix, you just say B times A should be the identity matrix. And then you ask the question, give me the B that best satisfies this condition. Then you write it as a least squares problem, and then you get a solution for B. So any matrix becomes invertible instead. That's sometimes called a pseudo inverse, and sometimes also the Penrose inverse. And lots of linear algebra was developed in the second half of the last century. So in that sense, a lot of modern linear algebra algorithms are actually younger than quantum mechanics. Of course, the roots of linear algebra, right? I mean, Gaussian elimination and so on. But algorithms that can handle large matrices with thousands or millions of elements, there was just no need to do that before you had electronic computers. Okay. What I wanted to do, go ahead, yes?
A quick question, Erica. I just couldn't follow up what happened there in the second line from the bottom.
This one here?
You set them to be zero? The third one, yeah. The third line that you set everything to zero.
Yes. Oh, this is the derivative of G. I don't know how to write that. It's kind of dg by dc. It's the derivative of g with respect to the coefficient c. So you take this line here, and you take a derivative with respect to c, and you get that line here. And we want to set that to zero. So we want to set it to zero, because then g is at an extremum.
Oh, I see.
And we know by construction that is going to be the global minimum.
When you do this differentiation by C,
yes,
the C A transpose B term, you get A transpose B, and then for the next term you get something like B A. But why do these combine to just be minus two?
Does the derivative commute with the transpose? I mean, because the air product of cross the A transpose B is like B A C all transpose.
Yes. Yes. I don't know how to write it down in the bracket notation. I do know how to write it down in abstract index notation, because anything like transpose and so on becomes trivial in abstract index notation. But I think if I had written this down in abstract index notation, it would have been more confusing. So I actually wanted to write it down using bracket notation. I was happy that you chose that. But this step is difficult to explain. You can also say that this term and this term, they're kind of symmetric overall, you can also use this term and take a derivative when it's written like this, and then because it's symmetric, you just take the derivative with respect to, you only take the derivative of the second term and you multiply it by two. Maybe that helps.
So implicitly we're taking a derivative with respect to each of the components of C, which makes everything nicely like scalars and
magnitudes. Yes.
Like if you
the first term was better. Yeah, I know.
Okay. Very good. Now I lost my train of.
Yeah, we could have just taken the derivative from the first line times it by two because it's a scalar. Exactly.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yes. Very good. Yes. Okay. So what I want to do now is I want to implement this. I don't know whether there's enough time to do that today or whether we're good to do that tomorrow. And this would also be the project that you need to finish. the project will start with this and then will extend this method to other things. So the project will consist probably of three pieces. The first would be implement this and approximate the sine function. And the next steps will continue to do that, maybe for different functions. I haven't written out the project description yet. Yes?
Sorry, to clarify, this project, is it a homework or is it like a bigger thing, like an exam?
There are going to be four projects for this course. It's going to be one of them. We're going to start tomorrow afternoon in class. You can work on that. You can ask questions how to get started. And in the end, it's going to be a GitHub project that you create and that you hand in. And well, there are no grades for this course, but it's going to be graded, so to say. Okay. Now another, go ahead.
I heard you said at the start of this lecture that this is going to be your second project. What was the first one?
That is the one that Dustin sends you. Because the beginning of the class is slightly weird, because we wanted to give an introduction to Julia and to GitHub and so on. The first one will be about representing functions, optimizations, and so on. And we haven't worked out the deadline yet, but each project, because the course is just 4 weeks, you should have about a week to work on each of these projects. And I've been told you ask for extensions anyway, so it's going to be a deadline for a week. Mm-hmm. But let me see whether I can restart that, and then I can show you something. Yeah, that's good, right? That's good. That looks good.
Oh,
you can't see? Why can't you see? I can see my screen. Okay.
Oh, there we go. Yeah, magic. Thank you, ghosts.
Oh, it comes back? Okay. Okay, I'm just saving my notebook just in case something goes wrong.
Space in it,
no, don't put any bold characters in there. Now, who knows what happened to my kernel? So restart and run all cells. And since we have this on the blackboard, I think what I'm going to do, I'm going to start implementing this, just laying it out, some of the things. I'm not going to have one complete thing that you need for your project. And I'm going to delay how matrix inverse works and so on to tomorrow morning for the 9 o'clock lecture. Good. Now the whole algorithm is called least squares, and I think it's clear why that is the case, because the function g is a quadratic function and you're looking for a minimum that function. Let's just define some constants. So we have number of. We have expansion coefficients. You know what? Instead of, let's call it Pmax, then it's clear what it is. And that is 4. And then we have.
Why 2 pounds? Just 1 pound.
Evaluation points, and then endpoints equals 11. We should use much larger numbers later on. And then if we have them,
where's the pseudo implementation?
Yeah, no. And then we have the points, and then x. Let's call these points in x. Is lin range, was it lin range? 0 and 2 pi and endpoints. Yeah. Oh, pi over 2. Thank you. And just as a goodie, you probably wonder how a computer internally evaluates the sine function. And of course, first the sine function is periodic. First you look at the argument and take mod 2 pi or something to find out in which quadrant it is. And one of these quadrants is 0 to pi over 2. And there you use something like a Taylor expansion. Except you don't use a Taylor expansion, because the Taylor expansion would be very, very good at one point, And the further you get away from it, the worse it gets. Rather, would want something that is kind of on average as good as possible over the whole domain. So you want to minimize the error over the whole domain. And that's that algorithm. It's not exactly that. There are a few things that are a bit naive here. For example, choosing the collocation that the evaluation points equispaced is not really a nice thing. It's better if you cluster them near the boundary and so on. And expanding into polynomials is not really a good idea. Orthogonal polynomials are much better. Do you know the orthogonal polynomials on the domain -1 to +1? That's the Legendre polynomials. You heard of them? And so you would do something like that, or maybe Chebyshev polynomials and so on. And yeah, of course, that's all linear algebra, right? So okay. So these are the collocation points. And then we have our, what do you call it? Call it a target function. And then write f of x equals sine of x. And what do we do now? Let's calculate that matrix. What is that matrix called? Forgot the name. Oh, let's just call it matrix. I hope one of you knows the real name. Or if not, yeah, then maybe not.
Like the
I called it A, but this is a, I think this particular matrix is called a van der Mond matrix because there are powers in there, but that's not relevant here. So we define this matrix A. And now we need to calculate it. And this matrix is just xi to the pth power. So it's xi to the pth power. And I'm using a, what's it called? List comprehension here to create it. And now I need to be careful that I construct A, not A transpose. I'll just do one. And I have no idea whether it's the right thing. So this now has how many columns? 5 columns. And our coefficients, we have 5 coefficients. So we can multiply A times C. So this is correct. So if I had gotten it wrong, I would have just transposed the matrix and invert the P and the I here. Okay. Now I think everything here is quite clear. The linear range to get the points that we have, that is straightforward. Defining a target function, which is the name, because I don't want to write something specific for sine. I want to keep it more generic. But this matrix here, that requires a bit more discussion. I want to make sure that you understand that. So the outer square brackets are a list comprehension. You can do that to create vectors and arrays. And I have 2 for loops in here to loop over the rows and columns. First the rows and the columns. And the rows are the number of points, the evaluation points that we have. And we just number them from 1 to n points. Up there, I try to number them from 0 to n points on the sum. Ignore that. I'm changing the notation here to keep you on your toes. And here, these are the expansion coefficients. They go from 0 to p max because I want to have a constant polynomial, linear, and so on, and higher polynomials there as well. And this here, xi to the pth power, that is exactly the expression that we had in our definition of f of x. Oh, man, yeah. I should not call the sine function f. Let's call it g. Now let's call it f star. Now let's call it f star like that. Because up on the blackboard, f is the thing that the model, so to say, right, that we get from the coefficients. And f star is the thing that we want to approximate. They're going to be different. So I should really keep the notation straight on this one. I mean, relabeling indices, sure. But changing other things is really complicated. Okay, and now we need to solve that system here. Oh, I did not show you how to solve a system in Julia. I'm sorry. That's, of course, the really difficult thing. Okay, time out. And so I'm going to finish in the 5 minutes here. Don't worry about that. Going to scroll up a bit. where the matrix A was defined. That was very high up. What's happening now? You know what? The scrolling has no future here. It takes way too long. I'm going to make a I'm just creating new matrices. I'm going to delete that again. Apparently, I like the letters A and X, so sure, why not? You know how to divide numbers? For example, you can write 2 over 3 in Julia. Julia also has an under operator, not just over, also under. You can write 2 under 3. And you see how the backslash goes in the other direction? Now 3 is over 2, so it's 2 is under 3. And the result, of course, is the other thing. I know. Now, if you have A times X equals B as an equation, then you divide by A on both sides, but it needs to be a left division because matrices that don't commute. So you don't, on the right-hand side, you don't get B over A, you get A under B if you solve it. And, confusing. I should have called these A and B, and then when I solve it, this is how you solve a linear system in Julia. You use this under operator, and this is the solution. And we want to calculate it, A times X equals B, and the result is?
Wait, sorry, how come we don't do B divided by A? Is it the
order? No, because AX is B.
You can't write B divided by A. Because then the left side, if you have a matrix equation, then left multiplying on the left and multiplying on the right is not the same. So we start with this equation here, and then we multiply from the left with the inverse of A. Then we have the inverse of A, and here, inverse of A times B. And here, inverse of A times A cancels. On the right, inverse of A times A is A under B. It's not B over A, because then we would need to move A on the other side. That doesn't work.
Does the matrix under notation work if we define A to be regular and B to be like the correct size column vector?
Can you ask that again?
Like if I had made A of size 10 by 15 instead, and then X would be 15 and B would still be...
Oh, yes, the operation works. It doesn't calculate inverse of A times B. If you write X over A, that calculates X times inverse of A. So it's a well-defined operation. It does what you do, and it's probably just the transpose of what I wrote.
There's a similar thing like this in MATLAB.
Exactly. Julia takes much of his notation from MATLAB. If you know MATLAB, you're halfway there.
But I don't know how to show what method is using for non-invertible matrices, because there are different methods that people use.
Oh, I wanted to get to that, because what Julia does for non-invertible matrices is least squares. So it looks at the matrix, and if it fails, you either get an error, but for a rectangular matrix, for sure, it just does least squares, the thing that I had here. But I didn't want to tell you, because I want you to implement least squares yourself and not just use the backslash operator. That would be cheating.
Yeah, I want to know what method he uses. And apparently he uses least squares.
Yeah, I assume it's least squares. What the documentation say, it uses the pseudo inverse. There might be other ways to do that depending on the matrices. But I think if you were to use least squares, you would get the same thing because it's the only thing that makes sense. Okay. Anyway, we have this. And oh man, sorry, I'm just trying to get order in my notebook here. This section should be further up. And then, of course, we have, how does it go? A transpose under. Okay, We start with B, and then we multiply with A transpose here. And then A transpose A under. So we have A transpose times A under A transpose times B. And this would be C. Okay, I'm out of time. This either works or it doesn't. Okay, you get a result.
I think the A is different right now.
So. Oh, because I didn't recalculate these things. Yeah, of course it would be. Yeah, that okay. There's lots of fun when you do these things interactively. And okay, this does not work. We are going to continue tomorrow. Look at it yourself. What we're also going to do, obviously, is plot the two functions f and see how the difference looked like. And we're going to try various number of points and so on and so forth. Okay. If you want to take a picture of the blackboard, I'm going to increase the lights, then you can see something. Thank you. Going to meet you tomorrow at 9 o'clock.